The Baker Type 2 Diabetes and Heart Failure Miniseries. Part 7. Type 2 Diabetes. Identifying cardiovascular risk is a critical aspect of clinical care.
Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Anita Sharma, a GP based in Brisbane. The mortality rate in people with type 2 diabetes almost doubles with the coexistence of cardiovascular disease. Typically, people with type 2 diabetes experience cardiovascular disease earlier and with greater severity. Risk assessment, therefore, remains fundamental to the primary prevention of cardiovascular disease to allow early risk factor modification and to target pharmacotherapy to those who will benefit the most. Given that majority of type 2 diabetes management occurs in primary care, it's vital that GPs regularly assess cardiovascular risk in patients with type 2 diabetes to improve outcomes. Today, we explore how GPs can efficiently incorporate CVD risk assessment for type 2 diabetes patients, both opportunistically and into scheduled health assessments. We have with us today Professor Jonathan Shaw, Deputy Director, Clinical and Population Health from the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute in Melbourne, who will provide valuable insights into a holistic approach for the management of type 2 diabetes patients who are at high risk for CVD. Welcome, Professor Shaw.
Yeah, thanks for having me along. Good to talk to you, Anita.
So let's discuss, why is it so important for GPs to understand CVD risk for patients with type 2 diabetes? Do you have any estimate of how many patients may be actually missing out on appropriate assessment and therefore timely treatment?
I think, unfortunately, this happens too frequently. Many people are aware of the links of diabetes with eye disease, with kidney disease. Not everybody knows about the links to cardiovascular disease, to MIs, to strokes, to peripheral arterial disease. It's often thought of as being something entirely separate, or that's to do with cholesterol or blood pressure or smoking. But it's a major consequence of diabetes and one of the most, if not the most, frequent cause of death among people with diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes. So it really is critical to, on the one hand, recognize that this is an important consequence and complication of diabetes, and on the other hand, recognize that the risk is not the same for everybody, that some people are certainly at very high risk, but others are not at such elevated risk and certainly not at a risk level that needs a pharmacological intervention. And identifying who is and who isn't in that basket is really an absolutely critical part of clinical care.
So the question is, how should CVD risk be assessed in people with type 2 diabetes? And does every type 2 diabetes patient need to have this risk score on file?
There is, as many people will now be aware, an updated Heart Foundation cardiovascular risk calculator, which has really taken us forward from where we have been in previous years. It's used quite a lot of updated data and newer ways of estimating cardiovascular risk, and in particular has a component of the overall calculation that is dedicated to people with diabetes and takes in some extra information about people with diabetes, about their HbA1c, about whether or not they have renal disease, etc. And so it gives us a more nuanced and more accurate assessment of their cardiovascular risk. And for people with diabetes, we should be doing this formally from the age of 35. Not many people at that age will require pharmacological intervention, but some will. And that's the age at which we should start to be recording what that cardiovascular risk estimate is and updating it over time as necessary.
So we know that GPs function in a time-pressured environment. So does the CVD risk have to be calculated only by GPs? Or could a practice nurse or, say, another diabetes-allied health practitioner do this assessment for us? And I think you touched upon it. But once it's done, how often should this CVD risk assessment be repeated and reviewed?
So it is actually quite simple to do, and most people will have the information in their medical records that would allow the risk calculator to be done. It doesn't need to be done by a highly skilled general practitioner. It can be done by other allied health professionals. There are some judgments that come into some of it for people who are in intermediate risk levels, and we might come on to those. but it can be straightforward to be done by other people simply entering things like the blood pressure and the age of the patient, how long they've had diabetes, what their recent HbA1c was, and it's all done online. I think that this now exists in some GP clinical software that might allow you to do it, but it's a very easy thing to do, and it gives a very nice sort of visual presentation of the risk in a way that I think many people can easily understand. So it isn't something that has to be done just in that precious moments that the GP has with the patient, where you can devote that more to interpreting the finding and what you're going to do about it. And I think that's where you want to devote your time.
And it's true, because nurses do a lot of this work anyway when they're doing assessments. They're entering height, weight, they're entering, you know, their lipid profile and other parameters. So you're right, the background work could definitely be done by our nurses and save us time to focus on the clinical considerations. If for intermediate and low-risk patients, like, we don't just do it once and then set and forget, we need to review it. And so what would be the appropriate intervals of reviewing these patients where we want to just revisit and maybe need to reclassify them with passage of time?
Yes, typically, I mean, this ought to be individualized and certainly should be rethought of if something critical changes. But typically for intermediate risk people, we're talking about reviewing that every couple of years. And for low risk people, probably every 5 years.
So what are the key outputs of this CVD risk calculator, and how do you define high risk?
So as we've done for many years, they're based on the percentage risk that an event, a cardiovascular event, will happen over the next period of time. This is 5 years time that this one in particular looks at. And so you get a percentage risk, meaning that if there were 100 people like this individual, this percent of them would have an event over the next 5 years. Less than 5% is deemed to be low risk, 5 to 10% is intermediate risk, and 10% and above is high risk. But one of the nice things, I think, about this is that it does allow us to incorporate some of the risk factors for which we don't have accurate enough data to really put numbers in, but we know are important. And these are the sort of risk modifiers. And this is where clinical judgment starts to come into this as to whether or not we should allow those to make a difference. So conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, for example, we know that that family of inflammatory conditions increases cardiovascular risk. We don't have the data to say by exactly how much. And so this risk calculator invites the treating doctor to consider that kind of risk modifier and wonder whether or not it might be enough to change somebody's 9% intermediate risk to 10% plus as high risk.
Now, could you give us some tips on how can we communicate the risk score to patients if more effectively, so that they recognize the importance of self-management and become more engaged? Because sometimes when we talk about percentages, it does not mean a lot to them. How do we make it a lot more meaningful to those patients?
Yeah, I think this is often a tricky thing. Understanding risk is challenging for healthcare professionals, and it's even more challenging for the general public. Again, the website that this is on does have some nice tools. You know, there are sort of images of 100 people and how many people would have an event over a period of time sort of illustrated, which is effectively just a picture of the percentage. I mean, I think one of the other things that people will often say is, well, how do I compare to everyone else? And it is quite interesting. We do have this focus on absolute risk, but I think that many people in reality think about relative risk. If I'm worse than everybody else, then, you know, I'm prepared to do something about it. I think that the other thing that is worth talking about here is this idea as to whether or not it's worth doing something about it. And many of the interventions that we have are fairly low risk in terms of adverse events. And the other thing that I will often talk to people about is the major role that age plays in this. And if you think you're a bit borderline today, within 5 years, you won't be. So we're having this conversation now. It's only going to get more in favor of you being treated over the next coming years. So some people would see that as meaning, well, okay, then if it's inevitable, let's get started now. Of course, we all know that there are other people who want to remain off treatment as long as possible. And again, there, this is very much a judgment from the treating doctor. And for me, this is where the absolute value of the risk rather than the risk category comes into consideration. So if somebody is 10.1% and so they're just into the high risk, you might treat that differently to somebody who is 15%. And so you should, because their risk is different, even though they actually sit within the same category. So all of those things are relevant in my discussions with people with diabetes.
Right. So Anna, we've been for many years now, we've been told as GPs to think beyond glycemia when we're managing type 2 diabetes patients and focus on implementing a comprehensive cardiorenal metabolic protective strategy for our patients, especially when we're choosing drugs. Could you just elaborate a bit on what are the guideline recommended, you know, treatment sort of options for reducing cardiovascular risk in our type 2 diabetes patients? And once we've determined the CVD risk score, how do we then make this treatment decisions?
Anita, I think this is a really critical point. And, you know, I think this goes back to the earliest things that we do with people with diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes. And so many people, as we know, believe that this is simply a sugar disease. You know, the only abnormality in the system is high blood sugar, they imagine, and they believe that it's caused by eating too much sugar. And so these considerations of this broader risk profile and the idea that diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes, is a much more complex condition than simply elevated blood glucose goes all the way back to there. And so this is relevant to dietary advice, it's relevant to physical activity advice, and of course, as you were saying, is relevant for pharmacological decisions. And so quite often, the best things that we can do to improve cardiovascular risk in people with diabetes is to advise them to stop smoking, is to get their lipids under control with a statin, and of course recognizing that statin therapy is for people who are at high risk, not necessarily just for people with high cholesterol or high LDL. Blood pressure control, and of course now we have glucose-lowering agents that, in addition to their benefits on glucose, have potent benefits for cardiovascular and renal outcomes. So all of those things come into consideration when we're thinking about the overall risk of a person with diabetes.
Yeah, so it's important not just to lower glucose, but how you lower it with the right choice of drug, which that does go beyond glycemia, perhaps is very important when we're making that decision. And what evidence is there to support the addition of these drugs, in particular SGLT2 inhibitors, in patients with type 2 diabetes and high cardiovascular risk?
Well, we now have a series of large multinational cardiovascular outcome trials that show beyond a shadow of a doubt that SGLT2 inhibitors and also GLP-1 receptor agonists have marked cardiovascular benefits. The history of this goes back now about 7 or 8 years with the EMPA-REG trial, which showed for empagliflozin, which was the first of the SGLT2 inhibitors to collect this kind of information, a marked reduction in cardiovascular and in renal outcomes, and that was MACE, which is MI and stroke, and even more so for heart failure, and then also for renal disease, that people with type 2 diabetes, and in that particular trial, it was restricted to people with type 2 diabetes and established cardiovascular disease, that putting them on an SGLT2 inhibitor compared to placebo had these marked benefits. And it was very clearly not a consequence of glucose lowering. We still don't really know what the mechanism is that links these agents to cardiovascular and renal benefits, but it isn't glucose lowering, but it's definitely there.
Mm. They, I guess the arrival of this class of medications, SGLT2 inhibitors, was indeed a game changer. So perhaps when we're reaching out for the next drug after metformin, I think we should think about, is this patient at risk of CVD or has already got established cardiovascular disease? And, you know, then consider using a drug like an SGLT2 inhibitor in preference to drugs that are neutral in terms of cardiovascular and renal protection. Would that be fair to say?
It would. In fact, I'd go a little bit further than that, Anita, in that I think that you started that, as we have all been trained to do and continue to do, that the decisions over glucose-lowering drugs are things that are triggered by elevated HbA1c. And of course, for some people, that might be above 6.5, for some above 7, and for others, it might be above 7.5 or even 8, depending on their personal circumstances. But really, before we think about that, we should be thinking about how are we managing their risk. Is this person at elevated cardiovascular or renal risk? And if they are, then we should be looking at their list of medications to see whether or not they have included in that an SGLT2 inhibitor or a GLP-1 receptor agonist. Because if they are at high cardiovascular risk, one of those agents needs to be part of what we are including, as well as statins, blood pressure lowerings, usually ACE inhibitors or ARBs.
Now, it can be very challenging to keep up with the changes in the PBS constantly. So what were the key changes that were made to some of the subsidized medications for the treatment of type 2 diabetes in June 2024?
The big change that we had was in some ways a simplification. We used to have, you know, several different codes depending on exactly what circumstances, what you were adding it to for an SGLT2 inhibitor or a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And so that has now been simplified for each of those classes. We've also seen a slight change in that the SGLT2 inhibitor class, at least from the PBS perspective, has been prioritized as the first choice for people among the SGLT2 inhibitor and GLP-1 receptor agonists. So the GLP-1 receptor agonists are now, from a PBS perspective, are only for those people with type 2 diabetes who are either intolerant to an SGLT2 inhibitor or for whom it is clearly contraindicated. And I guess the simplification is that it's an SGLT2 inhibitor is the first thing that one needs to think of. And certainly for those people who have increased cardiovascular risk and increased renal risk, this is definitely the place to start.
So I guess a clear message has definitely come through today that in a lot of our patients with type 2 diabetes, even though we may be reaching glycemic targets, that's not our only goal, and we should be thinking beyond that, because some of them are not benefiting from therapies that do provide additional cardiorenal benefits. Thank you for taking us through so comprehensively on the assessment of cardiovascular risk in patients with type 2 diabetes. Could you summarize the key messages for our GPs to take from our discussion today?
I think what we all need to bear in mind as GPs, as healthcare professionals, and you know, people with diabetes, that the real challenge certainly of type 2 diabetes is its complications. And that's predominantly cardiovascular disease and renal disease. Of course, retinopathy is important, and some of the other neurological and peripheral arterial complications. We need to be aware of the risk status of our patients. We need to update that on a regular basis. We now have very nice tools that we can use that give us these risk estimates. And those people who are at elevated cardiovascular risk need to have interventions, and that's lifestyle, diet and exercise, as well as pharmacological interventions that are directly targeting those risks and for which there is clear evidence of benefit. And that, of course, is the traditional statins, antihypertensives, ACE and ARBs. But now we have glucose-lowering agents in addition to this that have profound cardiovascular and renal benefits, and those need to be top of mind in people who have type 2 diabetes and increased cardiorenal risk.
Thank you, Professor Shaw, for that great, great explanation.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Anita.
Before prescribing the treatments discussed, please review the full product information. The substantiating references can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute in collaboration with Boehringer Ingelheim and Eli Lilly, and produced in February 2025. The views expressed are those of the individual speakers and may not represent those of the supporting organisation or Drive Time Radio Australia Proprietary Limited.